This is The Think Tank, talking about the major economic, political, and social issues of the week on the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3, KTAR. Here's Dr. Mike O'Neill and Mike Russell.
All right, welcome. Thanks for spending some time with us, Mike O'Neill. Dr. Mike O'Neill. See, if I was told the beatings would continue if I didn't say doctor. No. And I'm Mike Russell, along with a very special guest, longtime fixture of Arizona politics, and whom I believe is part of the Arizona state flag, Terry Goddard, joins us.
One of my favorite kinds of politicians to at least to interview, and that is a retired one, or at least
recovering
politician. Well, if you this, we're going to sort of go back and have sort of an Arizona history 101 here, and a lot of this over the last 40 years has been intertwined with the career in one manner or another of Terry Goddard. He was Phoenix mayor, twice elected attorney general, twice candidate for governor. But I got here, and actually in the second of two petition drives, I want to talk about the first one, which you were involved in. I think you were in probably, by my calculation, probably late 20s. And you were for a while as sort of the petition king of Phoenix. And the first set of petitions involved stopping freeways, as I recall.
Well, they stopped the tax. That's going way back. And you know, it seems like History 101 in almost any state in the union would be pretty dull. But in Arizona, we have a way of going in some unusual directions. And so I hope it's not that. But my first involvement in a political activity was when a gas tax was passed by the legislature, signed by the governor. At the time that Governor Babbitt signed it, he said it was an unconscionable fleecing of the taxpayers.
And signed it.
And he signed it. I always thought one of the great mixed messages of all time. Yeah. And a group of my friends and some, I guess you'd call them political activists today, but they certainly had not either run for office or been involved in campaigns before, but they were very concerned, A, about the tax increase, and B, about the fact that it all went for pavement and none of it went for any kind of bus service or transit, public transit. So we proceeded to get, at that time, the first petition drive in, I think, 30 years. Now they've become very common, but at that point, nobody had tried it, and certainly no citizens group had tried it. And we stood on street corners, and actually, because of our choice of target, we found gas stations were particularly good places to pass petitions because people were highly price conscious and did not want to see an increase in their gas tax.
And they were stopped and possibly even out of their car.
They were angry. And so we got an anti-tax movement was what I was involved in first. We got the signatures. And then the legislature, as they have the right to, this was a referendum, not an initiative. So it only puts the bill that they passed on the ballot. But they were panicked that the voters would actually have a say in this matter. And so they went back and changed the law. And at that point, our people were a little tired and they didn't want to refer it again. So we did get some positive changes. And actually, the Phoenix bus system basically was born from that effort. The funds to make expanded bus service possible came from that petition drive.
I remember the old joke used to be the Phoenix bus system is down, the bus broke.
The bus broke, absolutely. Yeah. And that wasn't a joke. That was actually the fact.
This was at least, if I'm reading between the lines here, at least as much a pro-transit initiative.
Oh, yeah. The people, it was a combination of anti-tax and pro-transit, and they came together. They didn't necessarily agree on everything, but they did agree that this gas tax was a bad idea.
So let's fast forward a little bit. Remind those of us who have not been here forever. What was Valtrans?
Well, Valtrans is where we should have gone, in my humble opinion. There was a legislative for the past, and one of the great leaders, I should say, of this whole effort, Jim Simmons, passed away, and his services were just this last weekend. And Jim was a bank president and a tireless fighter for better transportation in the Valley. And what he and some of his associates wanted was a half-cent sales tax, countywide, which would expand the freeway system. From what we had then, which was essentially I-10 and a little bit of 51, to something that looked like a system. And he was really a prophet, and he worked very hard to try to make that happen. But when it went through the legislature, they put it in two parts. They basically said, okay, we'll do a half cent now. This was in, 1985, I believe,
that era,
for expanding the freeway system. And we'll put a half cent pending a vote of the people for an expanded transit system. I learned at that point that if you want to support something, and I very much wanted to see both halves passed, you shouldn't have somebody who's an opponent of your position write the bill. And in this case, a fellow named Pete Kortstein, who was the senator and who wrote the bill, hated buses. He hated transit of any kind. And he wrote it in a way that we had a great deal of trouble passing and, in fact, did not pass. Valtrans was the result. We had a year of studying. We got all the Valley cities on board enthusiastically. But it was a countywide vote, so much of the unincorporated parts of Maricopa County did not think they'd get service, and they voted no.
And to compare that to the system we have now, it was what they called heavy rail. It was faster, it was sleeker, and it was far more of a comprehensive system than the single line that we have now.
Amen. And it went through the airport. And if I have a singular bone to pick with the current system, it's that it doesn't use the airport effectively. This is the single greatest destination in Maricopa County. Over 200,000 people go in and come out every day. And in my opinion, that's where any transit system should start and be centered. Our Valtrans system went in two directions from the airport. It went east and west. Obviously, it got into Glendale on the west and Mesa on the east. And it went north-south. It served South Phoenix as well as the areas up north. And I think you're right. Heavy rail, separated guideway. Essentially, it put the system on an elevated track.
In contrast to what you have right now, which the cars have to wait.
Well, I'm not an opponent of what we have right now, but frankly, I don't think it's as good an investment. You get tied up in traffic. You've got an average speed of 20 to 25 miles per hour. The Valtrans system never would have gotten tied up in traffic, and it would have had an average speed in excess of 50 miles an hour. So I think that's a huge difference.
And a cost difference, too. I remember having a discussion with the director of transit.
Oh, no, I don't really think so.
The director of transit at the time says if it cost $1 to build on the ground, it costs $2 to build above ground and $10 below ground.
Oh, that's true. There is a cost difference. But ultimately, the payback would have been incredible because it would have really given the whole county access to public transportation. Now I think we're going to get it. But it'll take many, many steps to get there. And we'll pay much more in the long run than we would have if we'd done it in 1989.
Real quick characterization. We just have a few seconds before the break. How satisfied are you with the current transit system?
Well, as you can tell, I'm not a complete fan. I think it's done a wonderful job of connecting downtown Phoenix with ASU. And that's been a market that, frankly, was unsuspected when it was passed. But it's really paid off well. And it's done much of what we hope that a good rail system would do. Not everything, but a lot.
Our very special guest, Terry Goddard, continues with us after the break. You're in the Think Tank right here on News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
You're listening to the Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona. News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
We're here with our guest, Terry Goddard. And Terry, you have been, I think, over the last 35, 40 years, one of the most consistent proponents of a vibrant urban downtown in Phoenix that I know. You're also one of the few people that's in public life who actually chooses to live in that area. I want to take us back over this 30, 40-year period, and I want to give you my observations and have you react to it. Early on, 70s, early 80s, there were attempts to bring in restaurants and get them viable in downtown. Most of those failed. There were sports venues and arts venues brought in, and then people would come down for those events, and there'd be a lot of people for a few hours, and then they'd drive back to Mesa or wherever, and you'd roll up the sidewalks in downtown Phoenix again. And then we had the combination, and the reason I can't separate them is they occurred at the same time, of light rail, and I think possibly more significantly, ASU in downtown Phoenix, and I think that changed everything. Your observations?
Well, what you say in the broad picture is pretty much right. I mean, my dad used to say that in downtown Phoenix on the weekends and after five, you could fire a cannon down the street and not hit anybody. And unfortunately, that was pretty much true. We grew differently than other cities, and it basically exploded in the 1950s. And so rebuilding downtown or even starting to build downtown Phoenix was a challenge from the get-go. And I think we suffer in Arizona and perhaps more in Phoenix than anywhere else with sort of a massive project syndrome. I remember when I first came in as mayor, we had just kicked off the second phase of the convention center. And everybody said, that's the thing we need. This would be, what, 1984. It's going to turn around downtown. It's going to make everything happen. It's going to bring in all the investment. Well, of course, no single project ever does that. But I think many leaders in this community still persist in that delusion that all you need is one more stadium or one more massive building and it'll all be fixed. And so there is no single magic key, in my opinion. I think the sports arenas were very helpful. ASU, as you said, is tremendous because it brings excitement
to
students.
See people on the streets.
Absolutely. And that's very important. But you also need a market. You need people with folding money. And students are not in that category, generally speaking. And so it's a combination of factors. It's lots of individual victories that I think bring something. But making the downtown interesting, having places like the ballroom there on 2nd Avenue helps to make a huge difference. You need a walkable city, and that's just beginning to happen. So those pieces are coming together. I'm really excited about it.
I think it's walkable. I think it's – but Mike O'Neill brought up a good point, that we go there and then we leave. We go there for a restaurant, then we take off. We go there for work, then we take off. Go there to see a Suns game. Well, some of us go there to see a Suns game, and then they take off. How about housing? What does housing play into?
Well, housing really important, and you put your finger on it on an important difference between Phoenix and other downtowns. Mm-hmm. Is you don't have a lot of urban residents. My wife and I and son are among the few, but that's growing. Right now, there's several, and they're not just ASU-oriented, several apartments coming in, very nice ones. There's a huge renaissance in the older buildings, the historic buildings in downtown Phoenix. Now, granted, that's a low-density neighborhood, but as people come back in, they're really raising, I think, the quality and the desirability of the whole space. So it's an overnight success that's taken about 40 to 50 years.
I've seen some neighborhoods along Central that I didn't see before. You go back after a year or two and you haven't been there, and you see development that is residential.
And here's the thing. We're finally getting what other places have had. Phoenix has had a sort of a rash about what you call infill. And high-quality infill development, and usually that means patio homes or low-density apartments. It usually doesn't mean high-rise, at least in my recognition. It's compatible with what's there, but it's at a higher density. That kind of thing we're beginning to get, and people are buying it. They're really interested in that style of living, and that makes a huge difference.
I think there may be one other thing that has aided this, is that urban living for millennials became cool again.
Amen. I mean, you don't have to have a yard necessarily to have a happy life. And I think there's a whole generation that seem to feel that way. They're far more entertainment oriented. And so the beginning of some quality entertainment down there is very important. And things like First Friday. If people haven't seen First Friday, the first Friday of every month along Roosevelt on the east side, I hope they will, because that's an exciting urban experience. I wish it was more than one day a month. But it gives you an idea what Phoenix could do.
What is First Friday? Never heard of it.
First Friday is an art walk.
I live here. Never heard of it.
Okay,
come on.
Come down. You'll find about 20,000 people or more that are just walking. They're being there. They're buying a little bit. There's some food, but there's mostly art galleries and craft galleries that are between Central and 7th Street on Roosevelt in downtown Phoenix. And please do it. I think you'll enjoy it.
Now, I remember when you started on this, and I remember some of the reactions was, you know, this is Phoenix.
Yeah, we
might drive down there in our car, but we want a quarter acre of grass. We want a swimming pool. That's why we moved to Phoenix. Now, I often wondered that your notions of urbanization have a peculiarly kind of Eastern, kind of Jane Jacobs inspired notion of urbanization. Now, you grew up in Tucson.
I did.
Now, where'd you get those ideas? In Cambridge?
No, not at all. I think Jane Jacobs and the Hopi Indians had a lot in common. There's a great deal about the Southwest that, frankly, could speak very, very passionately and effectively to folks who want to make dynamic, effective urban communities in this time in our lives, this time in history. And sure, I think Jane Jacobs said a lot about downtown Manhattan, which is universal. But anywhere that you have a substantial community of people and you want to have the benefits of that large community, which to me means cultural and economic, you need to have a certain amount of density, at least in part of your community. And I think that's what we've been fighting about.
Now, isn't another factor that this is some of the argument that people started with. If you're in a Boston, you're in a city that started in colonial times, so it had a built-in density. You had other cities, Chicago perhaps, that were built on the streetcar. Phoenix became a large city in the area of the automobile, so the infrastructure is inherently a little bit different.
We'll never be the same as those communities. We're not going to be San Francisco or Boston or New York, so people can rest easy on that point for all the good and the bad that comes with it. But what's being created in Phoenix is a new kind of urban area, and it doesn't make it non-urban. But what I think we failed to do is to cash in or benefit from our great size. So, we're number six in the nation, but we don't have cultural and economic. We're not the headquarters of very many firms nationally. We're certainly trying very hard, but we haven't quite made the grade in terms of cultural activity. So what I'm seeing in downtown today is both. We're becoming economically viable, and we're becoming far more interesting culturally. You see it also in downtown Tempe. So it's not going to be a unified, single experience. It's going to be divided.
Wait, we got to go to break real quick here. But downtown Phoenix, it's looking up. First Fridays, I'm all over that thing. That sounds
all right,
like
good.
That sounds like a good time. More with Terry Goddard, our very special guest, right here in the Think Tank on News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
You're listening to the Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
We're here with Terry Goddard and discussing a number of issues, and one that I find particularly interesting is the question of who runs Arizona, who runs Phoenix. Now, I came here having just read some really classic political science. Those of you who majored in this may remember some of this. There were two theories of urban governance. One was propounded by a Yale professor by the name of Robert Dahl. He lived in New Haven and he studied New Haven. And his conclusion was that governance is pluralistic. There's different groups that compete on different issues and shifting coalitions, and no one group controls everything. His intellectual counterpart was a fellow by the name of Floyd Hunter, who studied Atlanta. And his conclusion was that you had a group of people who ran the whole town. They were downtown. They sat in enclosed meetings. The business elite controlled everything. I moved to Phoenix in 1979, and I said, oh, my God. This is not only the Floyd Hunter model of community governance. They're actually formally constructed. They got a name, and everybody knew who they are. It was called the Phoenix 40. Now, that evolved over time. And an old-time Phoenix journalist and columnist by the name of John Talton, I quote him directly, he said, the legendary group morphed into the benign and toothless Greater Phoenix Leadership. In effect, it absented itself from Arizona politics. Now, yep. I think to some extent, you got cut your teeth sort of fighting some of the old Phoenix 40 in their what I think in their years when they were sort of losing their grip, or you may have helped bring that about. Do you think we'd be better off with them back in the driver's seat?
No. My whole career has been to try to make sure that folks, neighborhood organizations and so on, had their say at City Hall. I ran for mayor in 1983, way back when, specifically to open up the doors to City Hall and to get people more involved. And I think we did a lot of that with a number of programs I'd be happy to talk about. I'm excited about them still. But you actually leave out a historical section. Before the Phoenix 40, there was the Phoenix 3. Essentially, this was a city that was known for its corruption and for being wide open back in the 1940s. Mm-hmm. And the business community basically rebelled against that. They felt that they were going to lose the business of the two big air bases, yep. Williams and Luke.
Mm-hmm. And Due to corruption.
They changed. They literally fired the mayor, fired the council. Frank Snell was the leader of that group. He was a lawyer who founded Snell and Wilmer, a major law firm in the state. And the other two people ran the newspaper and the power company. And you could add the head of the major bank, Valley National Bank, to that group and have four very powerful people who basically got together and decided what would happen. And they served the community well. I don't like that force of government, but they gave clear decision-making, and they got Phoenix going. There's no question in my mind. The Phoenix 40 was sort of their successors, because as Frank yep. Snell retired and then passed away, frankly, that sense of control was being lost. And so folks got together and said, we got to get it back. They had something called charter government that for 40 years elected every mayor except one and every councilman except two.
And you worked, among other things, that we stepped over that to implement
a new district system. We were opposed by charter government, and we beat it.
It was the death knell to their control.
We beat them, and they went away.
When you had city council people elected at large, the newspaper endorsement was tantamount to election.
Yep.
When you had district-wide elections, then somebody could do it on shoe leather.
They could, and they've done it. And I think that's what we had in mind. And it was a big change for the city. It brought a lot of new talent to the story. A lot of new people got involved at that time. Now, perhaps like any system, it gets older and people get to expect certain results and they drop out. And I'm afraid that's what's happened in the city of Phoenix. You don't have the level of public involvement. You don't have the energy that we had in the 80s and early 90s. And I think we need to restore that, frankly. And Greg Stanton, I know as mayor of Phoenix, is very interested in trying some of the same techniques that we used in the 80s. And I wish him well. I hope that that's a very successful effort. Because unless the community is involved, if you delegate to a small group of people, whether it's 3 or 40 or 100, it means most of the citizens don't feel connected to their community. And they need to feel in order to have a positive feeling about their community. Let me talk about a quick product, if I can, because sure. I love seeing these around the country. City of Avondale has developed an app. You know, you got to have an app these days. And this one allows citizens to take a picture of a pothole or a picture of some graffiti, send it directly to the city public works department, and it gets fixed.
If you're in Newark,
that's cool. Look at that.
If you were in Newark, Cory Booker would come out and fix it himself.
Well, I that's a good thing. If Mayor Booker wants to do it, soon to be Senator Booker. But the bottom line is we need the citizens involved. And whether it's through an app and a digital photograph or whether it's coming to a long council meeting, I don't really care. I just want to have a sense of involvement, and the city has to mean it. It can't be just something that you go through because it's a ritual. It's got to have meaningful impact.
I like this app idea. The West Valley, where I live. That's right. That's coming. They're bringing it to the younger generation. I like that app. Maybe you can get city council meetings on an app. Just the notes.
Hey, the virtual town hall is an idea we started with literally before we had the kind of connections that you have today. And it ought to happen.
Right.
City council chambers ought to be interactive wherever you are because we have the technology to do it.
I want to tell you a hilarious story about that because this is in the era immediately following the Phoenix 40 and their running everything. And I remember that. And I remember you donated some of your pension money to actually fund that.
Yep.
Well, we held a series of focus groups with ordinary citizens about these Phoenix town halls. And I remember the extraordinary effort that you and others went through to bring in large groups of citizens to talk about the issues. Well, we brought in a group of randomly chosen citizens to talk about that. And you know what some of the undercurrent was? Yeah, that Phoenix town hall thing. That's just another one of these groups like the Phoenix 40 that tries to get together and control everything.
Well, you know, you can be suspicious of anything you're not involved in. And I think that's a hallmark city government needs to remember because it automatically happens. But we tried very hard. We had over 10,000 people that were part of the Phoenix Futures Forum at one time or another in its process. So a lot of them rolled up the sleeves and got involved. And if we saw a group that we didn't think was getting involved, we went out and recruited them.
Well, I think the point to me was, and I see this in a lot of our politics, cynicism combined with an utter lack of knowledge is a dangerous combination.
Amen.
It's conspiracies.
It's explosive.
I mean, the absurdity of this to me was I know the incredible effort that was gone through to try to get ordinary citizens to participate. This person was unaware of all of that and figured that it was some sort of private conspiracy.
Well, that's why the web and some of the modern everything from Twitter to Facebook and so on give you the possibility now to literally take away that excuse.
Well,
somebody wants to be involved in city government and the city is receptive to it, those are two big unknowns right now. but we have the technology to make it possible.
Well, let's return for just a second because to the issue of large business involvement in the government process, because some of the downside that you hear discussed now is we don't have any real leadership, and above all, we can't get anything done. Do you think that's a consequence?
It's a consequence of a couple of things. I think one of the challenges of public involvement always is how do you get to a decision? Because public involvement can mean endless discussion. And I believe that's ultimately destructive. So you can't have that. So I think what you have to have is leaders with vision that are willing to articulate it and put it out, and then avenues of participation so that people can either buy the vision or not, almost on a daily basis, but certainly at every election. But unless the voters demand a clear articulation, which they often do not do, and the leaders provide it, you're not going to get the sense of participatory democracy is a wonderful thing because it involves the participants buying off on the result. That's what you had in Periclean, Athens, and I believe it's what we had in Phoenix in the 80s. We need to have it again because that's what makes people have confidence that the public decision is the right one.
So in other words, get involved. Get your butts off the couch and get involved. And stop complaining about everything that's going on in Phoenix and get up and get involved. Take some action.
Yeah.
Always argued for and very, very difficult to pull out.
Very difficult to do because the barrier to entry is at least perceived to be very high.
More with Terry Goddard. You're in the think tank. News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
You're listening to the think tank on the Voice of Arizona. News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
We're here on the Think Tank with our special guest, Terry Goddard. And we have for you, Terry, a kind of a concluding question. And it's a long question, so forgive that. And the question is, in Phoenix, are we too small-minded? Do we always reject big things? I'm thinking back historically. We have a big proposal like Valtrans. It gets rejected. We end up with a smaller version of it. Rio Salado on a grandiose scale is rejected. Tempe puts in a small version of the same thing. Or what I think was the granddaddy of them all. If you go to the state capitol, you can see the Frank Lloyd Wright rendering of the incredible 22nd century version of a Phoenix capitol that could have been iconic. I mean, iconic at the level of you think the Tower of London, the London Parliament, Red Square, the Jesus over Rio, at that level, that is, and I would encourage people to go down there and look at how incredible that is. And always the answer is the same. We can't afford it. It's too expensive.
Oh, I didn't think we could be up there with the Christ of the Andes. That's a magnificent thought. Yeah, I have a picture of the Frank Lloyd Wright rendering in my house. I think it's one of the great dreams. But dreams often, even when they're not achieved, they help to achieve reality in perhaps a cut-down version. So everything that you just mentioned, and they're all things that I was at one time or another a strong advocate for.
Rio Salado, I think the Frank Lloyd Wright thing was before you were born.
It was. That was before my time, but I would have been for it if I'd been around. Because it helped to set a new standard and a new image for our community. But the fact that we have moved slowly, I mean, public debate is about compromise. It's about discussion. And sometimes ideas get rejected in the public marketplace. Every one that you have, even if it's a good one, doesn't necessarily get implemented. We had a wonderful job effort to try to design a new community center and civic center for Phoenix. And we had great architects do it. That didn't get built either. But we've got a very, very dynamic municipal center now. Not what I wanted, but I think we set a high standard, and then people maybe have reached a little further when they finally got the job done. So I think the important thing is you have a vigorous public debate. It doesn't always come out the way I want it, but it doesn't may not come out the way everybody does, but the public's involved. And I think as we get that more of the, I'd love to be able to say that Phoenix is the most involved community in the country, because I think that would say a lot about how people, the kind of confidence they have in their community. I think we've slipped from that standard, but it's re-achievable. Can we make a decision? Yes. I think with leadership, you can make decisions in the public sector. But they used to say that Pericles, the great thing about his leadership in Athens, and I'm going back a few years. Yes,
just a few.
That's before Michael's time.
He knew how to deliver bad news. And the Athenian democracy accepted him as their leader. He didn't always tell them everything was wonderful.
This was after the phenomenon of killing the messenger, right?
Well, hopefully, yeah.
Well, yeah.
Or having a messenger die as he arrives.
Okay, but, last quick question.
But here's the bottom line. I think what we have failed to have is leaders that could say the good as well as the bad as well as the good. And we got to get over that.
It's hard to run on the bad.
Well, who?
It's hard to run on the bad, but the folks need to understand, everybody does, that it's not all perfect. And there's some bad news out there that needs to be delivered and dealt with.
I think that's a very, very worthwhile thought. I think a lot of our politics involve new programs or new ideas where inevitably there's some benefit and there's some cost, and all the negativity focuses exclusively on the cost, where as in life, like anything else, it should be a balancing of the two. Is this worse? Not does it have a cost, but is it worth the cost?
You need to be realistic, and you need to reject those politicians that say, I'm going to make everything wonderful, because they're lying.
For no cost.
They're lying.
For no cost.
For no cost. President Obama was here last week, and I didn't see a lot of comments about this, but he talked about housing, something that I've spent most of my life working on.
I left out of your bio. Yeah, you were a HUD officer in between some of those other jobs.
And I was encouraged specifically because he didn't have a new program. He came in and said, look, we got to do the basics better. We've got to do the financing better. We've got to get the public dollar out of the housing market so it can stabilize itself. And I thought, wow, this is nobody talked about it because it wasn't a glittering promise of great future wealth, but it was very sensible.
And I'll tell you why. And I'll tell you why I think that is. I think on both counts, it works both ways. The new program, but the cost, I don't think all the negativity is on the cost. I think it's on new program fatigue. I think as voters, as citizens, we think, oh, great. Here comes another program, another government program. Let's expand the tar out of this whole thing.
A new acronym.
Right. And then Obama comes along, and he we would have heard that, but I think we almost have Obama speech fatigue. So well, you hear the first 5 minutes, and you think, okay, we've heard that show before, but then he says great things, and it gets lost in the shuffle.
The talking heads had said, my God, the president was here, and he didn't promise a new alphabet
soup.
Holy
mackerel, look at that. Wow.
Maybe the millennium has arrived.
Well, the critics will take that as a do-nothing president, right? That's I suppose, some of the appeal of doing something new.
I take it as practical leadership, yeah. And I think we need a big dose of it, and we haven't had much.
Right, and we definitely do. Mr. Goddard, thank you so much for
thank
being
you.
Here.
It's a pleasure to talk about
so
a few years ago
here.
And cities that I love and think can be continually improved.
And now I'll turn to you, Doc, as we wrap this up. Your biggest takeaway right out of the gate for who runs Arizona? Because I thought Arizona for several years was run out of Durant's down off of Central.
I think that was a lot of years ago.
You walk into that place, it bleeds history.
And it was the Adams Bar.
Absolutely.
Before that.
Yeah, I had a great little piece of history that I bought up there some years ago. There was a liquor bar was selling out all the wine bottles with the old Adams House label on it.
Oh, that's cool.
And I said, not only history, I wanted to buy. I went out and bought one bottle and took it out in the parking lot and tasted, and it was pretty good. Went back in and bought them out.
Well, there you go. A man after my own heart.
Well, it is true. There was a time when the legislature essentially met at the Adams Hotel in the bar.
Wow.
And at least the decisions were made there. And you mentioned Durant's. That was the next restaurant to
And
to
you
be
have us. To translate. Adams Hotel, that's now the...
I don't know. They seem to have a different name
every
year.
It's not the Hyatt. It's not the Sheraton. It's the other one.
It's the other one. It's on Adams and First
yes,
Avenue.
It's
First
the
Street.
Old one. Yeah.
But
yes.
It used to be the center of power. Power is very diverse in Arizona today. And anybody can claim it. That's some people see as a negative. I think it's our strongest suit.
Yeah, I think that would be my answer to your question, Mike. I don't think there is a successor to the Phoenix Park. There is no one entity that controls our politics. It is more of a hodgepodge. There are interest groups out there that have exerted power. Center for Arizona Policy has been in on a lot of social issues and exerted a lot of, you see that in a lot of legislation, but they certainly don't control everything.
Right.
But there is no equivalent of the Phoenix 40 out there.
Now, I want to move on. Now, once again, your wheelhouse is public opinion, and I heard, it wasn't these exact words, but small town thinking in a big town. We're the sixth largest.
We're the sixth largest town around. Though we get a little over full of ourselves about that sixth largest city.
Okay, talk to me about that.
In the sense that we're about the 30th largest metropolis. It just so happens that Phoenix annexed so much land that the city of Phoenix is disproportionately large compared to, so for example, it's bigger than San Francisco, but the Phoenix metro area is nowhere near the size of the San Francisco.
I'm not even going to listen to you. I'm not even going to hear you on that.
That's
we're
the
number
professor
six.
Speaking right
yeah,
there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
As boosterism, number six is pretty cool.
Hey, Well, we're big. Yes. I would say we're big.
We're big.
We're getting bigger. And we're going to keep getting bigger.
Slowed down a little bit, but the growth path
Well, sure. And I think that's healthy in a lot of aspects as well. But I think
it's going to pick back up. Old Barron's critique that Phoenix has one industry, and that industry is growth. We could use some more diversity in our economic base.
All right. So is that hamstring us right now? Is small thinking in a big time?
I think it does. Yeah. I think that it has probably hampered the fact that for a city of that size, for a metropolitan area that size, we're shy in terms of top-notch corporate headquarters. And one of those that we have, we're on the edge of maybe losing the old America West, now U.S. Air.
Well, let me put out a challenge on that, because it's. I think it's true that the old answers don't apply. The same people that they used to defer to are either not there or they don't have significant power, which means all of us have responsibility. And perhaps what's needed now is some big ideas, some people, whether they're on the council or in the city at large, to say, here's what Phoenix can be when it takes the next step. And unlike other cities that have fully developed and filled in all their spaces, we still have steps ahead of us.
What would your vision be?
Well, I think we could be one of the premier cities in the world. I think the one I've always talked about is we could be the premier desert city. We could be the solar city. We could be the city that uses its resources more effectively, and we can provide, in addition to diverse centers, because we'll never have one singular center in this metropolitan area, but we can have some specialization.
Well, and Detroit figured out that that's not such a great idea.
What's that?
To be based on any one thing.
That's right. Let's not do a Detroit.
Which was the richest city in the country in the 50s.
And now it's mostly vacant lots.
Right.
Let's not make that mistake. We're an automobile city that's now adopting transit. We're going to do it in a different way. But we could be the cutting-edge city of the information age. And I think that's where Phoenix's great potential lies.
Well, I'll say I'm going to put in my vote as the Hyperloop center of the nation. Hyperloop sounds cool. You guys into Hyperloop?
I don't know what that
means. You don't know what Hyperloop is? Hyperloop, Elon Musk, no one known to Hyperloop. Look at this. You guys see?
But you've never been to First Friday.
Hey,
so
I'm the educated one.
That's one for one.
Who would have thought? Holy mackerel. I'm actually the educated one in the room. All right. That's all the time we have. Terry Goddard, thank you so much for joining us. It has been a pleasure. You are truly a man of action, and I know Phoenix and the state owes you a great deal of thanks for all of your service. Dr. Mike O'Neill, you can find him at O'NeillResearch.com for marketing, public opinion research. MikeO'Neill.org for blogs, articles, any types of videos, all the good fun stuff. And me, heck, you can hear me every darn day here on News Talk 92.3 KTAR.